Welcome to The Extra, the show that connects you with the people, issues, and topics that are important to you. And last week on The Extra, we were talking with Dr. Michael Harper with Optum about coronavirus, about the pandemic, how it's changed and altered how we experience medical care, and certainly the lives of those who have contracted it, and how it's transmitted, how we can protect ourselves. We tackled a lot of those questions, but there were still some questions that we had remaining. So we invited Dr. Harper back on the show again today. And Dr. Harper, thanks again for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me again.
You know, it's always nice to talk to someone who has that medical experience and depth of knowledge like Dr. Harper does. He's been a family medicine practitioner for more than 20 years, and he just recently joined the Optum East team. Want to mention that. But let's talk about when we talk about coronavirus, I'm assuming during the past 3 to 4 months, we have learned certain things about how we treat patients who are who have contracted it. What have we learned so far about what are the best practices in treatment?
Well, the one thing that we've learned is that we don't have a really good treatment yet. We've learned that 80% of the people are around there, it's not much more than a minor illness. Some body aches, cold symptoms, runny nose, sore throat, coughing, congestion, even some diarrhea. So usually treating those things as you would a cold, with cough suppressants, for the fevers, Tylenol. Initially they were saying no ibuprofen, but that seems to have gone by the wayside, that it's okay to take ibuprofen now. Fluids and rest, as well as the main thing is isolation. The thing that when we're working at the, I work at one of the clinics where we check people to, if they think they have coronavirus, is you're checking people's oxygen levels, making sure that they're in a normal range. And that's one of the things that seems to drop in people as they get sicker. And so the other 20% of the people that have the coronavirus, those are the people that can get very ill, that need to be hospitalized or maybe placed on a ventilator. And they're finding that their oxygen level starts to drop before they get really sick. So it's one of those that where they can watch that and say, okay, your oxygen level's dropping. We need to, you know, get you more oxygen, get you more some kind of support. Go ahead.
Sorry. has the need for ventilators in the treatment, has that stayed the same, or have we started examining when ventilators are deployed?
Well, that's exactly it. They're starting to determine better when you need to put somebody on a ventilator. And that oxygen is one of the things that they're better able to tell. If it's dropping, the people may need more ventilatory support than if the oxygen is holding steady. They're finding that it may cause multi-organ failures, where your heart may not work as well, may cause arrhythmias, kidney failure. They're noticing that some people's blood is clotting more, which can cause damage not only to the lungs but to other major organs. So each of those things, the specialists are trying to figure out, okay, how do we treat each one of these things, and who is this happening to? It's a lot of examination by the specialists that are out there, the hospitalists, and it's a collaboration where it's sharing information amongst people that may not ordinarily share information. I was reading an article the other day from a hospitalist, and he was talking about how prior to this, the sharing of information kind of comes when the article comes out. People do a study and they put an article out and then read it, and then people share information based on the article. Now they're calling other hospitals and they're talking to other hospitalists, and they're trying to share this information as it's coming out, so that people can make changes to treatments more quickly, because this illness is evolving so fast. Mm-hmm. So it's bringing out some really good things as far as collaboration amongst medical professionals, at least across the country and hopefully across the world.
And do you think that's because in the medical profession, there's this realization that any delays, that really means the difference between life or death. If you can't get, maybe an advance or improvement in treatment to these patients in a more timely fashion.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when it hit, we weren't quite sure what was coming. We didn't really know what it was going to be like. And then when it hit, and we were all watching what happened in New York, and that started to really perk people up, is like, okay, they're getting hit hard. If this starts to hit everywhere hard, what are we going to do? We don't have the support for it. We don't have the staff for it. Hospitals were not were sort of becoming places where you go if you're sick or if you're having a procedure, and then let's get you out of there because we don't want people hanging around the hospital because that means they're not well. We want them out in the world well. Now all of a sudden we're being flooded with a lot of sick people, and sick people with an illness that don't know a lot about. So in order if you're able to talk with other providers and gather that information, then the flood that could come might be better handled.
That is so correct. And we will continue this discussion with Dr. Michael Harper. We're talking about the evolution of the treatment of coronavirus and COVID-19 patients by the medical community, how collaboration is ongoing, how it's been even deepened by the need to bring help and bring assistance to these patients quickly. So we're going to continue with this conversation in just a moment after these messages. Also, ahead, we're going to be talking about the search for vaccines. That's coming up a little later. The Extra continues after this. We're back with Dr. Michael Harper, and we've been talking about and extending our conversation on coronavirus treatments as well as what the future holds. Dr. Harper is with Optum Health, and currently he's at Optum East, if you're interested. But we are talking about right now some of the best practices and sharing the best practices. Let's talk about people with COVID. Do all people who get COVID end up in the hospital?
No. Fortunately, the majority of people, and by that I mean 80% or thereabouts, do not end up hospitalized. They have symptoms that are usually around similar to a cold or the flu: body aches, cough, runny nose, sore throat, diarrhea, low-grade fevers. So most of those people can stay at home and self-isolate and take Tylenol or Advil, stay up on their fluids, and they're going to be fine. Some people it lasts a couple days. Some people it may last 2 weeks. There's also people, and as I'm sure most people have heard in the news, that have it but don't even know it. I've worked in these clinics, as I mentioned, where people come in and they're concerned that they may have it. And a lot of people come in and say, I got a runny nose and I got a little sore throat and a bit of a headache. And I think it's just allergies. But they've never had allergies before. Or they do have allergies and they're probably right, it's allergies. But they're concerned because of the coronavirus and the symptoms that they want to be evaluated and possibly tested. So, most people definitely do not end up hospitalized. It's the other 20% that kind of are the ones that may be hospitalized.
And
I
do we know, and do
saw
we know what makes the difference between the two?
We're not entirely sure what makes the difference. Age seems to have a pretty big impact. Definitely, the older we are, seems to hit harder. And as you get over 60, 70, especially over 80, that's where the big impact is. But also having other chronic medical conditions, such as diabetes or kidney failure, heart disease. Those things seem to play a part in how bad it may affect you or how at risk you are. And that's one of the things that sort of has changed as this virus has gone on. When this first started, and we were working in the clinics and seeing people who we thought had it, the only people we would test were people that were deemed to be at high risk. If you kind of fell in the category of healthy and didn't have a comorbid condition and didn't have a direct exposure, you didn't travel to China, you didn't just get off an airplane where people had the coronavirus, you didn't get off a cruise ship where people had the coronavirus, we weren't testing. And we weren't testing because we weren't sure how many people we were going to have to test, and how well we'd be able to keep up with that. And again, how badly this was going to affect people. But if you had those conditions, then we were testing. Within it was probably a month, then it started to open up and said, all right, if you've got any of the symptoms, you've got a low-grade fever, if you've got a cough, you've got a sore throat, you've got body aches, then we should probably be testing you. It truly is an evolution of learning about how a disease, progresses, who it hits. So that, it's the learning process on any illness. It takes time, just like anything that we do. You can take a class on speaking Italian, but it's probably until you actually sit down and talk with somebody who's Italian, or you go to Italy and try your wares, you're going to learn as you progress. So illnesses are like that. We learn as they go. People start going, oh, look, they have this rash on their toes, and or they've lost their sense of taste, they've lost their sense of smell. People start communicating that information, then you start asking that question, and then people start answering those questions, and you start to learn, this is how it spread, this is how the disease progresses, and this is how we can treat it. It's been fascinating to watch happen. As somebody who grew up in the time when HIV came out, when it first kind of hit the market, if any of your listeners
Oh,
remember
right.
what that was like, it was terrifying. We didn't know. We didn't know if you could go to a public bathroom. We were
Sure.
concerned that you're going to catch it from that. And as time went on, we were able to figure out how it was transmitted, who was at risk for it. And now they've got some really great treatments for it.
Knowledge gets
Hopefully
refined.
it doesn't take that long.
Right. Knowledge gets refined as more research goes on. And speaking of research, that's what we're going to be tackling in our next couple of segments here on The Extra, is the research and the search to find a vaccine. That's coming up. But before we let Dr. Harper go, I just want to say thank you, sir, for joining us for The Extra. And if you would like to find out more about the Optum team, you can call 719-522-1133 or visit cosprings.optum.com. Dr. Harper, thanks again for sharing your expertise.
Thank you for your time. And remember, everybody wear your mask.
And wear a mask. Mask up. Hashtag. All right,
Mask up.
we'll be back after this. Welcome back to KRDO News Radio's The Extra Show. I'm your host, Shannon Brenius, and this is the show that connects you with the people, issues, and topics that are important to you. And today, our focus has been the COVID-19 pandemic. We've all been dealing with the impacts for more than 3 months now, and seeing the impact on jobs, on families, on education. But now we're starting to think about what comes next, when we will start to be emerging from this, and what the impact will be on all of us as we start to emerge from this. And so joining us now on the KRDO Newsline, we have Barron's reporter Josh Nathan Kazis. Thanks so much for joining us over the phone.
Glad to be here.
So you've been looking into some of the scenarios that could play out as this pandemic continues its march across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, over the next 6 months, things can go lots of different ways. We've seen better outcomes in some countries, worse outcomes in others. It's looking like the U.S. is heading in a not great direction right now, but there are ways in which things could change over the next few months.
Explain that. What ways could they change, and what should we be looking at as far as indicators?
So look, I mean, the most immediate issue is whether the states that are seeing vast increases right now in the number of cases, whether they take measures to slow that growth using the things that other countries have shown worked, mask wearing, social distancing, closing down of, certain stores and businesses. And we have over the past few days seen some of these states taking these measures. There are some counties in Florida that are reversing some loosening of restrictions. We've seen Texas institute a mask mandate statewide. I think that is an indication that governors and local officials are trying to do what they can to stop the growth in new cases. We'll see over the next few weeks whether those measures expand and whether they're successful. I think in the midterm and longer term, we can start thinking about pharmaceutical answers here, or at least pharmaceutical advances that could help blunt the crisis. There's been progress recently on a number of fronts, on vaccines and also on therapeutics. And we can go into them separately, but I think the therapeutics aspect gets overlooked a little bit. And there's
Right.
an interesting category. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, right, everyone seems focused on a vaccine. I know Colorado Springs, actually, a company here has been chosen to run one of the trials for Moderna for a vaccine. So I know that, that seems to grab all the attention, but therapeutics do have a valuable place.
Yeah, both as a stopgap and also, it may likely be the case that whatever vaccine ends up working doesn't work for everybody, may not work as well for older people, and for people like that, certain types of therapeutics will be important. So, I think the most interesting category right now are these so-called antibody drugs, and these are essentially, drugs that are made of the same thing that our immune system creates when we're trying to fight off a particular virus. These are synthetic antibodies that they have identified that appear to be pretty good at fighting the virus that causes COVID-19. And there are a number of companies that are now beginning tests of these antibody drugs that they have developed. There's some news this month from a company called Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. That's a pretty large biotech firm. And they have an antibody cocktail, sort of a mixture of a number of antibodies that they're testing in both patients who have been exposed to the virus but not gotten sick yet, and in people who have gotten sick. And I think there's a lot of hope that this drug will be able to help people not get sick who have been exposed, and also shorten the duration of the illness if people do get sick.
So interesting, Josh. Well, we do have to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be hearing more from Josh Nathan Case's Barron's Reporter talking about coronavirus and what comes next. You're listening to The Extra on KRDO News Radio. And we're back with The Extra on KRDO News Radio. We're talking with Josh Nathan Case's Barron's Reporter, who's been investigating the medical community's response and efforts to try and find a vaccine for COVID-19. Do you think the FDA is going to be, I guess, playing along with authorizing any COVID-19 vaccine this year? Are there any indications that they are open to that should the trials be showing something positive?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. The FDA has put out guidance recently saying basically what they're going to want to see before they approve a given COVID vaccine. And those guidelines are pretty careful to emphasize safety. And that's kind of the FDA's main mandate, right, is to make sure that drugs that we take are safe and effective. And they've made very clear that they want this vaccine to be pretty effective and very safe. Now, obviously, you have to wait. Yeah.
Go ahead.
You have to weigh that against speed. And what the FDA has not been so clear on is under what circumstances they would issue what's called an emergency use authorization for a vaccine. That's the FDA saying, you know, we haven't totally approved this particular vaccine, but because of the circumstances, we're going to let people use it. And it's possible, you know, they said they would consider it on a case-by-case basis. It's not clear whether that could happen this year or not. But certainly other parts of the government are rushing to get something ready before the end of the year.
Mm. Let's talk about those specific makers of possible future vaccines. For instance, Pfizer. Where do they stand in their development process?
So Pfizer has become a really major player here, and they're following a very aggressive timeline. This is a company that has partnered with a German biotech firm called BioNTech, and they're working on a type of vaccine. This is going to get a little bit, a little technical, a little scientific, but it's called, it's a messenger RNA-based vaccine. Without getting too deep into the weeds, it's a kind of vaccine that people have been working on for a long time, but there are no examples right now of approved messenger RNA-based vaccines. Now, there are a lot of companies working on messenger RNA-based COVID vaccines, including Moderna, which you mentioned earlier. Pfizer is hoping to have all of their testing done and or at least ready to submit for FDA approval by October, which, again, is a rather aggressive timeline. But, you know, if there's a company that can do it, I mean, this is one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies. They have enormous resources, enormous experience. And they're pushing really hard on this.
And then circling back to Moderna, where do they stand in their similar process?
Yeah, Moderna is working on a vaccine that is similar to Pfizer's. This is a biotech company that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years. It, as a company, does not have any approved drugs yet, but it has a very large pipeline of drugs, again, based on this messenger RNA technology. Have been were some of the first to begin testing a COVID vaccine. They're, as we speak now, about to begin their sort of phase three final step trials. They said they hope to be done, I think, around Thanksgiving, you know, ready to submit for approval around Thanksgiving, or at least to have data by Thanksgiving. Now, we should consider that normally a vaccine takes a decade to go through all the testing, and these companies are saying they can do it in a matter of months, just to give you a sense of how accelerated these timelines are.
And those accelerated timelines, I remember hearing earlier, may not be fruitful. I mean, we may be pushing for a vaccine to get developed, but it could be that they don't unlock the key to this, at least in that quick of a timeline. What happens if we get to, say, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas, and so far nothing has been shown to be effective?
Yeah, I think we should totally be ready for that possibility. I mean, science is hard and vaccine development is particularly hard. You know, vaccines are drugs that you give to healthy people. So you need to be very, very careful that not only do they work, but also that they're safe. So there's a very high bar. And I don't think that anyone wants to get into a situation where people are getting a not useful or a dangerous vaccine. So it's quite possible that people will look at the data from these early studies and say, you know, this vaccine is not the one, or this vaccine we need to look at a bit more closely. And the good news is that Moderna and Pfizer are not the only companies working on on a COVID vaccine. And although a lot of companies are working on COVID vaccines using relatively new technologies, including Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, there are other companies that are working on COVID vaccines that use more established technologies. And again, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but so the bottom line is that Sanofi and GlaxoSmithKline, which are two of the largest drug companies and two of the largest vaccine makers in the world, they're collaborating on a COVID vaccine that won't be ready until sometime next year, but it is based on a more established technology. In fact, a technology that Sanofi already uses in one of its flu vaccines. So I think that, you know, if these earlier, more risky approaches, or at least more aggressive approaches, don't work, there is a backstop, which is this more established approach. And the ones I've mentioned, the four I've mentioned, are, again, only a handful of the many, many companies working on this. So, you know, there's no guarantee we'll get a vaccine, but I think we can be hopeful that over the next year or so, one of these programs will hopefully come up with something useful.
Right. One of the images that keeps coming to my mind is a dartboard, and you know, with three or four dozen people standing, you know, 30 feet back, all trying to hit the bullseye. And, you know, maybe someone's going to hit the bullseye, but also maybe not, or maybe a couple will hit the bullseye. And it seems like that's the stage of things that we are dealing with right now, as far as looking ahead to a possible vaccine or therapeutic treatment for coronavirus. And with more than 3 million people sickened worldwide, it certainly has an immediacy, an urgency that something needs to be done, hopefully as soon as possible. But as you mentioned, this is a process that normally can take a decade, if not longer. Thanks so much, Josh. We really appreciate your insight and information. And of course, Dr. Michael Harper, prior to that, as we've been talking about the evolution, the journey of the medical community, as well as the scientists who are seeking to find better treatments and a vaccine that will hopefully prevent the spread of coronavirus. You've been listening to The Extra on KRDO News Radio. I'm your host, Shannon Bernius. Have a good day.